Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
Basically, you had, from the very beginning of civilization, you had a distinction between public banking that was trying to make the economy grow and private banking that was trying to benefit wealthy families at the expense of the tax collector and at the expense of economic stability. And rulers in the Bronze Age had a much more sophisticated mathematical model than is used in the textbooks today, because they realized that finance isn't really part of the economy. Finance is external to the economy. It's sort of wrapped around the economy, and the laws of financial growth, like the stock market, the bond market, have nothing to do with the economy of production and consumption at all, but they tend to intrude on the economy, draining more and more income out of it, and leading to debt deflation, and or what economists now call secular stagnation, without realizing that this slow growth that we're having in actually is the result of the way we've mishandled the financial system.
Did you get that? The heart of our economic mechanics, controlled by private issuance of debt, is both fundamentally unsustainable, historically repudiated, and anathema to democracy. Those claims come from the mouth of the person considered by many to be the world's best economist, Dr. Michael Hudson, our guest today on a special edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Hello and welcome. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host for this next edition of discussion about what's behind our continuing struggles to make our money work for everyone while we address the failing social metrics of our financial system. Today, Ellen and Michael discuss how it came to be that a debt matrix got adopted by our economic system, even though Hammurabi dealt with its failings almost 4,000 years ago. The basic operational problem with debt is that it can't continue indefinitely without killing its host economy. Debt is a predator that ultimately eats everything in its path, if not forgiven. This is what the ancient rulers did periodically: eliminate debts in a jubilee fashion so the economy wouldn't devour the people who kept it alive. We see evidence of how this is playing out in America with the devastating hollowing out of our middle class and the destitution that is showing up in increasing numbers of our fellow citizens. It is truly unsustainable, and to change it will require a new level of understanding about how we are trapped in a system run by a few financial elites and their political agents. And of course, it is one reason why the idea of a universal basic income is emerging as a reasonable and necessary adjustment to this debt-based economic system. Today's conversation with Michael Hudson and Ellen will be along shortly. As you may know, we talk about money from many different perspectives and like to talk about its many different perspectives. It has so many dimensions, most of which are foundational to the functions and prospects of our lives and our societies. While Michael Hudson, a former archaeologist prior to his economics career, can reach back into the beginning days of money, it is today's monetary horizon that shapes what we're able and not able to do. Ellen is currently seeing that firsthand from a different perch.
Ellen, you've traveled all over the world, and this week finds you in Colombia, South America, doing a host of things that puts you squarely in front of an economic contrast between how much it costs to do things in America and how much it's costing down there. It's an interesting aspect of our money that is worth noting. What are you noticing?
Yes, actually my son lives here and works here at a university, and he loves his work, but he gets paid very little, and you wonder how people can live on those salaries. But everything is very inexpensive here. That's how. You can take an Uber practically anywhere for a couple of dollars. They don't have zoning like we do, so the grocery store is like right next door, and the medical thing is right across the street, and the hairdresser is two doors down, that type of thing. So everything's very convenient. Of course, imports are expensive, but everything that's made here is very, very cheap, and help is cheap. And actually, one reason I came was that I needed some dental work, and it was a lot less expensive here. But they seem to have the same equipment, using the same materials. How can they do it for so much less? Well, first of all, they're not paying Beverly Hills rent. And second of all, they didn't go to a U.S. university where they have a $200,000 in student debt that they have to pay off. They probably went to university for free. So anyway, that was just interesting. There's a lot to be said for living in the third world, if you call this the third world. Anyway, for living abroad, which brings me to the subject of the article I'm working on why it is that Chinese families can actually afford to own their own homes. It seems that 90% of Chinese families own their own homes, and 80% of the homes are owned outright. In other words, no mortgages, etc. That's totally different from the U.S., where less than 65% of U.S. homes are owner-occupied, and more than 50% of the equity is owned by the banks. So they don't really own it. You know, they don't own it till they pay the thing off. So we are led to believe that the Chinese are exploited. It's slave wages, and that's the reason they can afford to work for less, and that's one reason that this is considered an unfair trade practice, that the Chinese are exploiting their workers and that they subsidize their industries. But in fact, what I argue in this article, with a lot of sources, of course, is that the real reason is that their costs are a lot lower because they are subsidized by the government. So education is subsidized, healthcare is subsidized, transportation is subsidized. Those really big costs are subsidized. So they can afford to save. So they save up for their down payment. Sometimes they save up for the cost of the whole house before they buy the house. And now they're changing the laws in the U.S. so we don't have those no doc, no down loans anymore. So people do have to save up a fair amount of money before they can buy a house. So you don't see millennials rushing out to buy a house like in China, like they do. I mean, there are cultural reasons why the Chinese particularly value owning their own homes. One is that because they had that one child policy for a long time, there are a lot more men than women. You wonder what happened to the women babies, but we won't go into that. And so in order to score a wife, it's considered essential that you own a home. So the family does help out with buying the home. But even in the U.S., even if the family did help out, there are very few. I mean, it's your average family could not come up with the cost of a house for their oldest son, even if they wanted to, because they can't save, because all their money is going for rent and health care and just the basic necessities of life. So it seems like our values here are a bit skewed, where we're saying it's unfair trade practices on China's part to be supporting their workers and supporting their industries. We should be supporting our workers and our industries and just sort of joining them instead of penalizing them for what's actually a good practice. So it's kind of an upside-down world.
Yeah.
Orwellian.
Our guest this week, Michael Hudson, does a brilliant job in describing really how the monetary system is built in the United States in the neoliberal economies around theft, basically, of the financialization debt that adds debt on top of the real cost of things, and that's a losing proposition, and that debt will always outpace the ability of the people to keep up. So we're locked into this cycle. And as you've pointed out, China, because 80% of its banks are owned by the government, is able to do all kinds of things that America should really be out there able to do, but can't because of the debt load. I think one of your statistics was that they've built 12,000 miles of high-speed rail in the last 10 years. We can't even get from San Francisco to L.A.
Right.
So our system is twisted and certainly reflected in the lives of the people. I hope that people will listen carefully to Michael's description of our predicament and how he goes back in history thousands of years to disclose or to describe why debt forgiveness was so essential to the economy, to keeping it going and to keeping the balance in it. Because when debt is centered in the hands of a few, the rest have to, of course, pay and pay and pay and pay, and that imbalances the government as well as the economy. Michael just does an amazing job making it so clear.
I'm reading his book, which goes back 5,000 years and traces the whole system and just shows that the way we've been taught of what money is and how it evolved supposedly by barter and it evolved privately is not true. It evolved as a public function. And to me, it's just amazing. I mean, how did these civilizations originate this, not just the money system, but everything like written language and all the civilized developments came in all at once with Sumer and Egypt, and a mystery at best.
I thought his point that it was a public function to begin with, that the temples and the palaces, the centers of power, were providing the monetary foundation of exchange, and that periodically there would be a forgiveness of debt that enabled the economy to continue, and without it the economy would collapse. But even worse than that, if the people weren't able to get debt forgiveness, they would leave. They would go off to another country, or they wouldn't fight for the country and whatever. And it just kind of brings to mind certainly the predicament we're in now, where home ownership is down, the cost of education is beyond the means of many, and things are not working very well, and there are so many people getting out of the labor market. Now, the very idea of having universal income seems to equate in some ways to this debt forgiveness notion that Hudson talks about.
Right, because we can't really do debt forgiveness in our culture. I mean, the Chinese could do it because our debts are not issued publicly. They can't be forgiven by the government. They're private. So the other alternative to fill the gap between the debt and the money available to pay it is to put some more money out there. And I have argued in numerous articles and places that you could do this without creating inflation. And the Chinese, in fact, do it. In the last 20 years, they have increased their money supply by a factor of 8, almost 8. And they haven't created inflation. They've got 2.2% inflation. So how do they do that? It's because they have increased their GDP by even more. So supply is going up along with demand, so prices remain stable. So that's the thing. You can increase the money supply as long as the money goes into the real productive economy.
And that's the modern monetary theory, which is emerging, being discussed vigorously on all kinds of levels. Of course, being poo-pooed by the people who think it's fantasy. But if one spends a little time with looking at what's being said, you can realize how logical it is. And hopefully that will become part of the national conversation as we look at the needs for the Green New Deal's requirements for capital, which cannot possibly be paid for under the mechanism of debt that we are relying on now. Well, okay then. Enjoy your stay, and looking forward to reading your article on China coming up, and then also hearing more about your book.
Yeah, actually, it's being revised right now, so June 1st is our publication date for the upgraded paperback, and the Kindle is actually available right now. Banking on the People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age.
A very important conversation right now. Well, Ellen, thank you very much. Safe travels and enjoy Colombia.
Okay, thank you. It's my great pleasure to be talking today with Dr. Michael Hudson, who has been on this show before and really needs no introduction, but I'll introduce him anyway. Michael is a Wall Street financial analyst, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of 25 books, if I've counted them right, with more on the way. He has advised governments worldwide on finance and tax law, including Iceland, Latvia, China, and Greece. According to former Assistant Treasury Secretary Paul Craig Roberts, he is the greatest economist on the planet, and that sounds about right to me. So it's great to be talking to you, Michael.
It's good to be back.
Okay. I'm really interested in your latest book, which I'm privileged to have a copy of, called And Forgive Them Their Debts, which is the first of a trilogy on the history of debt. So in it, you trace the history of our monetary system going all the way back to Sumeria and Babylon and show how usury finance has wreaked havoc on it. In ancient times, they fixed the problem with periodic debt jubilees, where they would, you know, after the debt built up too much, they would forgive all the debt. But we can't do that today because it's no longer the king who has control of the debts, it's private banks. So that's all very interesting and very relevant to public banking, particularly. I've seen where you've said that since we can't go back to having divine kingship like we did in Hammurabi's time, that we need a civil law that would control the oligarchy, and that would include public banking and public credit, which, of course, is totally relevant to the show. So I wondered if you could give us like a capsule summary of your message and tell us what prompted you to write this trilogy.
Well, I began to write the book in order to look at how debt began and how our societies had coped with the fact that debts tend to grow faster than the ability to pay. And throughout the Bronze Age, that is from the 3rd millennium, 2nd millennium, and even in the 1st millennium BC, from Sumer and Babylonia all the way to the Judaic lands, the starting point of all economic regulation was a simple recognition that debts tend to grow faster than the ability to be paid. And the question is, what should a ruler do in order to maintain stable growth over time when you have debts growing so fast? The Western way of solving it was to let the creditors control and end up with a few narrow oligarchies in control of all society as one smallholder and landholder after another loses their liberty and their land that they're foreclosing creditors. But this wouldn't work in Sumer and Babylonia and the rest of the Near East, where interest-bearing debt actually began, because they realized that if you let the small farmers end up pledging their crop and their labor to the creditors, then, first of all, if they have to work off their loan to the creditors, then they're not going to be able to work at the corvée tasks, the building the infrastructure, building the irrigation canals and the walls and the palaces and all of the public buildings and public infrastructure that made society work. And secondly, if they lost the land, then all of a sudden they wouldn't be able to pay their taxes and their crop taxes anymore or make other payments to the palace. palace, and the palace would basically go bankrupt while the whole economic surplus, instead of being paid to the palace to finance this public infrastructure, would all be paid to the creditors. And then finally, as more and more labor and land and rents were paid to these creditors, they would develop into an oligarchy, and the first thing they'd try to do would be to overthrow the king to prevent the king from canceling the debts and returning the land to people who'd farmed it. So from Hammurabi's time in the 1750 BC, already in a half a millennium earlier in 2250 BC, in Sumer, you had the Sumerians rulers. Every new ruler taking the throne would start by a clean slate, by restoring order and canceling the debts. Hammurabi would cancel the debts. And the idea was to restore an economy in balance where there weren't any debts. In addition to canceling the debts, you would free the bond servants, the people who'd pledged their labor to work for the creditors, and you'd return any lands that were foreclosed. Now, these three elements were word for word the same elements as the Judaic Jubilee year in Leviticus 25. And in fact, the Hebrew word for the debt cancellation for the Jubilee year, Duror, was a cognate to the Babylonian word andararum, which meant sort of running freely. You let the bond servants run back home. It's the same word as the Sumerian amargi, which meant a return to the mother condition. And so basically, for thousands of years, the rulers would say, we realize that there's no such that economies don't naturally tend toward equilibrium. The economies naturally tend to get further and further out of order, and they tend to polarize between rich people and poor people, and specifically between creditors and debtors. And they actually had an economic model for this. They had the growth of debt, which is exponential. Any interest rate is a doubling time. And in Sumer, the interest rates would double every 5 years. Today it takes maybe 15 years for them to double. But finance lent out at interest doubles every period, but the economy tends to slow down in an S-curve. So they realized that at a certain point, if the amount of debt service owed exceeded the economic surplus available to pay taxes and available to undertake new investment, and so that's why they'd wipe out the debts. Well, you could say that all Western civilization, from Greece and Rome on, basically has been based on a denial of this simple mathematical principle. The pretense today is that somehow all the debts can be paid if you just have a free market, and what they don't realize is that the debts can't be paid, that if you don't write down the debts, then the debts are going to grow more and more rapidly relative to income, that the people's debt service that you owe for your credit card debt, student loans, and car debt, and mortgage debt is going to grow faster than your income, so more and more of your income is going to be paid to the banks, and the banks are owned by about 10% of the population today. The wealthiest 10% own most of the bank bonds. So you end up by paying the banks by paying the 10%. Well, the problem today that Hammurabi didn't have was today, if you cancel the debts, then you're going to get the wealthiest class very angry at you, and they will give campaign contributions to a politician who promises not to cancel the debts. Well, Hammurabi didn't have this problem because most debts were owed to the palace, and they were owed to the palace because of the main debts were tax debts, and it was the palace and the temples that would make most of the loans and also sell most of the products on credit. For instance, in Babylonia, if you would you basically get your money once a year at harvest time, and when you get the money on the threshing floor, you'd turn the crop over and to the temples, and the temples would measure it all out, and you'd pay everybody you owed money to. And during the year, you'd not want to go out to a bar or an alehouse. So the alewoman would mark down whenever you went. She'd keep a tab, and you'd owe so-and-so much money for beer. And at the end of the growing season, the harvesting season, you'd pay the alehouse lady, in addition, who got her supplies from the temple, in addition to other people. Well, it was easy for Hammurabi and Bronze Age rulers to cancel the debts because most debts were owed to them. The problem is today, most debts are not owed to the government banks. Even the student loans, even though these are all government guaranteed, even your mortgage loans, even though 90% of the mortgage loans are all federally guaranteed against risk, they're owed to the private bankers. And the government can't simply say, okay, we're wiping out the debts that are owed to a Citibank and the other major, Wells Fargo and the other major banks, because this would also wipe out people's deposits, and the whole banking system has become privatized. Now, just imagine what would have happened in 2008 if Sheila Bair, who was head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, had her way when one of the most crooked banks in the country, Citibank, who Sheila Bair said was the most incompetently run bank, as well as being a lawbreaker bank with junk mortgages and massive fraud, she wanted it to go under. Said, look, it should be wiped out. You shouldn't reward the crooks, and you shouldn't reward incompetence. They made bad loans. The stockholders should be wiped out, and the bondholders should lose the money because they've invested in something that's basically a crooked operation that is not only crooked, but it's incompetent. And that's the price if you back someone incompetent. And she said, well, we can always take it over by the FDIC. Now, imagine if Citibank would have become a public bank at that time. The government would have taken it over. How would a public bank have been different from what Citibank did? Well, it wouldn't make junk mortgage loans. It wouldn't make loans for corporate takeovers to close down factories and empty them out. It wouldn't make all sorts of payday loans or loans to payday lenders. But the Citibank could have lent for public purposes, including it could have set up its own low-interest payday loan to people. Well, Sheila Bair was overridden by Obama and his Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, who said, it's all about the bondholders. The bondholders are our major campaign contributors, and our loyalty is to our campaign contributors, not to the voters. And Obama called the bankers in, and he said, you know, I know that there are a lot of newspapers saying because the banks are crooks, we should let them go under and publicize them, but don't worry, I'm the only guy standing between you and you bankers and the mob with pitchforks. That was his term for what Hillary called deplorables. They were his. He called his voters the mob with pitchforks. And he said, you know, don't worry, my loyalty is with you. You're my campaign contributors. I'm going to make the big banks even bigger. They're not going to lose a penny. The bondholders won't lose a penny. We're going to make the stockholders rich. And we realize that we'll have to foreclose on 10 million homes. We're going to have to reduce home ownership. We realize that this is going to especially hurt black owners and Hispanic owners, and that they're going to lose their homes, but that's the free market, and I'm a free market liberal with you. Well, if this would have happened in Hammurabi's time or in the time of Israel time, when something like this did happen under when Judea tried to impose all sorts of taxes and debts on Israel, and Israel simply withdrew and said, we're not benefiting from this arrangement. And in Sumer and Babylonia, the populations, if they were in debt and the ruler did not write down the debts, they'd simply run away. Or when there would be an enemy attacking the city, they'd go over to the side of the enemy. And this happened all the way down through early Greece and Rome. In Greece, a general wrote a book. He was called Tacticus, and he said, if you're attacking a city, the way to win is you promise to cancel everybody's debts, and they'll all come over to your side. But if you're defending a city, then you also promise to cancel the debts, like Coriolanus did in Rome and Zedekiah did in Judea, and that way you'll hold their support. No, of course, afterwards you can then double-cross them and re-enslave them, but by that time you'll have won. And in other words, what Obama did is exactly what the Bible denounced Zedekiah for doing, double-crossing his people. But right now, most Americans don't have who've lost their homes, don't have the option of emigrating to another country where are they really going to go? And so the situation is doesn't have as much flexibility or freedom as it did. But the difference is that in antiquity, even in Greece and Rome, the first banks were basically either temples or palaces. And so banking began in the public sector. None of this is acknowledged by the usual textbooks of money and banking that somehow say, well, money was created by individuals bartering. They just preferred silver and copper and gold. But we know from archaeology this isn't the case, and that it was the temples. Our word money comes from the temple of Juno Moneta in Rome, where the silver and gold coins were struck during the Punic War, basically to pay mercenaries. So you have from the first maybe 3,000 or 4,000 years of civilization, money being created by the temples and palaces. The creditors were mainly the temples and palaces, the creditors at interest, and they regulated the economy because if you are the ruler of society, you don't want there to be a polarization. You don't want to grind out a lot of poor people, and also you don't want a lot of rich people coming in who will then say, well, the first thing we want to do is just what the Republicans and Democrats do in America. We'll have a free market and we'll elect politicians who let us enslave the rest of the people and take the economic surplus for themselves. All the way through the Byzantine Empire, you had this fight between central authority wanting to keep the population debt-free and the oligarchy that wanted to get them into debt in order to grab their land, just like what happened in America after 2008, and grab their labor to work. So basically, you had, from the very beginning of civilization, you had a distinction between public banking that was banking that was trying to make the economy grow and private banking that was trying to benefit wealthy families at the expense of the tax collector and at the expense of economic stability. And rulers in the Bronze Age had a much more sophisticated mathematical model than is used in the textbooks today, because they realized that finance isn't really part of the economy. Finance is external to the economy. It's sort of wrapped around the economy, and the laws of financial growth, like the stock market, the bond market, have nothing to do with the economy of production and consumption at all, but they tend to intrude on the economy, draining more and more income out of it, and leading to debt deflation, and or what economists now call secular stagnation, as if the stagnation that we've been in for the last 10 years is somehow impersonal. It's just something that happens on a chart periodically, without realizing that this slow growth that we're having in right now actually is the result of the way we've mishandled the financial system.
Mm-hmm. We don't have the relief valve of a debt jubilee. So for that reason, it seems to me we need a universal basic income, and because we don't really have any other alternative, we could fill that gap between the amount of money that's created or the amount that's owed on the debts and the amount of money that's actually created in the form of loans by putting new money out there, like all the time, which is pretty much what the Chinese do with their qualitative easing. What do you think?
Well, that's the point. Compare what we're doing to China. Everybody's saying that China is going to have a big crash because its companies are very highly indebted to the government. The government has creates the money in China. It advances it to the companies so they can build the factories and employ workers and buy the raw materials they need. And it's true that a number of companies now say, well, you know, we've done all this investment. We paid all the workers, but we can't afford to pay the debts. What's the Chinese government going to do? It has two choices. If it followed the American rule, it would say, okay, you're going to go bankrupt be sold at fire sale prices, and the Americans are going to buy it, and then they're going to treat your employees like they treat their American employees, like people who work for Amazon. Or we can just say, okay, you can't pay the debt. We want to keep you in business. We'll just forgive the debt and write it down so that you can keep on going. So the result is that when China has a company that's like General Motors that is near bankruptcy, it doesn't China doesn't let it go bankrupt, and especially it doesn't let it go bankrupt and be sold to either foreigners or to wealthy Chinese. It keeps the factory and employed, and it keeps the workers employed, and it keeps the economic system running. Now, it's easy for the Chinese government, the Bank of China, to write down the debts because the debts are owed to itself. But imagine if these companies had borrowed from private banks or from, let's say, HSBC, the British bank that is over there. If China would cancel the debts owed to HSBC or an American bank branch there, or even a wealthy Chinese branch, you'd have an international incident. You'd have protests. You'd say this is against the law. You would have a political fight on your hand. China doesn't have a political fight like that because it doesn't have any independent vested financial interest whose interest is in bankrupting the economy, paying the workers as little as possible, and impoverishing the economy and imposing austerity. And that's the interest of the financial sector in the United States. So when people are saying, why is China growing so rapidly and the United States isn't, the answer is that the American economy has been financialized and the Chinese economy has kept a dual economy, a mixed economy, with the financial sector in the government sector as a public utility. Now, that's what all the classical economists thought in the 19th century. Everybody believed that all the necessities of an economy, land ownership, banking, the railroads, health care especially, all these, it was the Conservative Party in England, Benjamin Disraeli, in the 19th century, who said, health is all. And we have to have a public health system because keeping a healthy population is how we make a productive labor force that can compete with labor of other countries on good terms. So what Obama and Donald Trump call socialism today used to be called progressive capitalism. And it was the capitalists and the business schools that said we need public investment in basic rent extracting industries or rentier industries. We need public investment in railroads, infrastructure, public health, banking, so that this won't be monopolized and used in ways that hurt the economy, because the government's role is to benefit the economy as long as there's a democracy. And somehow we've moved away from democracy into an oligarchy without quite realizing it. Most Americans keep thinking we're in a democracy, but it's already, as you saw with Obama, saying that his loyalty was to his campaign contributors, the wealthy, not to the voters. That's just a sign saying we're in an oligarchy that now is busy trying to make itself hereditary by getting rid of the estate tax and turn into a hereditary aristocracy, which is just what happened in the transition from Rome to feudalism.
Mm-hmm. Well, one problem that China does have is they have a sort of runaway housing market, but I think that's largely from the shadow banking system. Am I right?
It seems to be. What happened is that the banks have lent to entrepreneurs who borrowed from them and then turn around and they can borrow from the bank at, let's say, 4% interest, and they'll make mortgage loans at 6% interest. And they've let these intermediaries bid up the prices of housing. There's been a big policy discussion in China, and especially this occurred last year at the Second World Marxism meeting, where David Harvey and myself urged China to wipe out the debts, and that would wipe out this whole shadow banking system of wealthy moneylenders who, if you let them grow, you're going to end up with them taking over the government in due course and ending up looking just like America. And we thought that China should drive them under by essentially imposing a land tax that would collect all of this rental value that reflects the increasing prosperity of China. And this should be the tax base of the government, not because you want to raise the cost, but because you want to prevent people borrowing, hoping that house prices will increase. You want to say there's not going to be a land price increase, because if there is, we're just going to collect it away, so there's not going to be a special class of mortgage bankers that are going to get rich off the fact that the country is getting more prosperous without their doing anything for it. So the question is whether China is going to protect these shadow banks and mortgage lenders and try to keep housing back down, because it is a problem in China. If you want housing, you have to pay a very high price, and just like the United States, you usually have to go into debt in order to buy a house. And if you have to go into debt, then that means your money's not going to be available to spend on the goods and services economy that China wants to create.
Mm-hmm. I've just been writing on the fact that 90% of people in China, or families in China, I guess, own their own homes, which is way more than we do. So we have this conception that the reason that Chinese labor is so cheap is that, they're being exploited and they don't, very low wages, slave wages. But how can that be? I mean, how can they be all buying their own homes if they're so poor? So you've actually been there. So I just wonder what your sense was of, you know, how the Chinese workers really are doing and why it is that they can afford
the Chinese are paid low wages in U.S. dollar terms, but they live pretty well. And the reason is that the prices are very low. They have public medical care. They have very good public transportation. They have all the things that America has to pay for, provided basically by the government as a public service. Now, just imagine that if workers in America got all their goods and services for nothing, they'd get all their cars, their clothes, their food, everything they buy. Imagine if you'd give it to them free. They still could not compete with China, because the medical costs alone take so much of their income. The rental, the housing costs alone take up to 43% of their income that's guaranteed by the federal government. And the tax withholding that makes them pay for Social Security, it's called Social Security, but that's the euphemism for tax cuts for the rich, for the donor class. This income transfer upward is so high that Americans could get everything for free, and they still couldn't compete because of all these added costs that are not economically necessary at all. And we know they're not naturally necessary and not technologically necessary, because China doesn't have them. Soviet Russia, bad as it was under the bureaucracy and inefficient as it was, at least didn't have the rentier charges of debt service, rent, public health, and things like that. So the Americans don't realize how much of the family budget is completely unnecessary and has been imposed by basically the equivalent of landlords or feudal lords, or a parasitic class that gets the money in their sleep. That was the term John Stuart Mill used in the 19th century. The rentiers are people that collect interest and land rent and monopoly rent without doing anything except charging more, like the pharmaceutical companies that get monopoly prices for their drugs. So the American economy's been further and further malstructured, and Mr. Trump, just like the Democratic leaders, try to blame China on this, as if it's China that's malstructured the American economy. And all China has done is avoiding the kind of malstructuring that the neoliberals have created throughout in America and Europe since really 1980, with since Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher in England said the economy should be run for the rich people with the purpose of concentrating all property and all the economic surplus in the hands of the 1%. That's the neoliberal program, and they realize what they realized in Babylonia, that under a free market without the government acting as a check, pretty soon all of the economic surplus is going to go to the 1%. And this is exactly what happened in Rome when the Romans overthrew the kings and then for five centuries assassinated every political leader who wanted to cancel the debts, was killed. Tens of thousands of their followers would be killed in each wave just to make sure that the debts were in place. And it was Rome that bequeathed this sanctimonious character that debts take are the primary form of property, and the creditor rights take precedence over homeowner rights and land rights and human rights. And so we're living now, you could say, in a diversion that Western civilization has made since Rome, away from democracy towards oligarchy.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that was interesting what you said about Social Security. So how is it that Social Security is, you know, bled off to the rich?
Well, they collect much more. They've imposed a tax on all wage earners of 15%. They call it Social Security. You could call it whatever you want.
So
you could call it a world peace tax. But this money gives the government much more money than it actually pays out for Social Security and medical care.
Right.
And so this extra money enables the government then to say, now we can cut taxes on the rich. We can cut their income taxes. We can cut their sales taxes. And we'll just call it Social Security because that's a nice word, whereas the real world word should be taking money from the middle class and giving it to the 1%. That's really what you could call the FICA wage withholding in everybody's pockets. And the whole myth that people have to pay for their own Social Security instead of this being paid for the government, even Bismarck in 19th century Germany thought Social Security and pensions should be what any industrial capitalist country does in order to maintain a solvent population, because industrial capitalism needs a home market. It needs people to afford to buy what they produce. Otherwise, we're going to have economic shrinkage, and the population will all leave for other places, like so many Europeans left for the United States when the United States still had a more progressive policy. So basically, the government in America can do what governments throughout the rest of the world do. They could simply print the money to pay Social Security, or they could tax the rich for it if they want to make sure that no rich class exists, comes into existence, that uses its wealth immediately to fight against good government and say, we want to dismantle government, we want to be a libertarian. And to be a libertarian means we want a centralized economy to be planned by Wall Street, not the government. So the libertarians and the free marketers are even more centralized than Stalinist communism in Russia. But they want a centralized planning in the form of Wall Street and the 1%. And the problem is when that happens is exactly what happened in Rome. The 1% is going to plan the economy to extract more and more income from the rest of the economy in an adversary relationship. And really, that's the position of the financial sector and the real estate sector and the monopolies today in America against the wage earners, without the wage earners realizing what Warren Buffett said, that there is a class war going, and we, the 1%, are winning it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's so interesting. So one thing that really interests me about your book and was the whole connection to religion and the gods. And I mean, where did these people come from? That I remember going to when I was 20, going to the British Museum and being just struck by, you went into the 4th century BC Egypt room, or 5th century, I don't remember. Anyway, there was nothing there, you know, just hovels. And then all of a sudden in the next century, or the next millennium, sorry, you had this amazing civilization that was, you know, the top of the Egyptian civilization, and then it degenerated from there. So, like, how did these rulers manage to persuade people that they had the divine right of the gods, and who were the gods, and where did they come from? I don't know.
The gods were really what they called basic morality. They said, look, there's a basic ethic of rulership, and the basic ethic of rulership is you don't want people to lose their status. You don't want them to fall down the economic ladder. You want to protect the people who are, if they have to run up debt because they're sick, or because the man of the household is killed in war, or because of a crop failure, we have to protect these families. And if there's a crop failure, then the debts aren't going to be owed, and we're going to cancel them. And just as the Babylonians, every new king would proclaim a clean slate Everybody's in balance. The balance sheets are all reset. Nobody owes anything to anybody except for mercantile debts. The Egyptians had a Sed festival, a festival where they'd canceled the debts. And when you were in the British Museum, you probably saw the Rosetta Stone. And what everybody knows what the Rosetta Stone is, you know, the trilingual translation, but hardly anybody realizes that that's a debt cancellation. And it's canceling the tax debts that are owed to the pharaoh. And it was done by a 14-year-old pharaoh. By that time, the Greek Alexander's generals, Alexander the Great's generals, had conquered Egypt, and the Egyptian pharaohs were all Greek by that time. But the 14-year-old was mentored by priests, and the priest said, look, if you really want to be a pharaoh, you've got to do what the old pharaohs did. You know, you're 14 years old, the country really is sort of poor right now, you have to have a debt cancellation. So let's do the, and that's what the Rosetta Stone was. Well, you can imagine the embarrassment of the creditor class and people and the neoliberals and the historians. They'd much rather say that finally Napoleon's troops found the Rosetta Stone and they could translate Egyptian hieroglyphics without saying exactly what these hieroglyphics were saying and were all about.
I've heard you say that the business model of the big Wall Street banks is fraud, and it's something that the Chinese are sending their young people over here to get educated in economics, and then they're picking up the whole neoliberal model, and you're warning that this is a big disaster. But so could you just explain that about fraud being their business model?
Well, you can make much more money by fraud than you can by acting honestly. Crime pays. That's the basic thing that should be at the center of every textbook. If you want to say how to make money, you become a criminal. I mean, everybody really knows that. But you want to be a criminal at the top. You don't want to be a dumb guy who just, you know, grabs little amounts of money. As my colleague Bill Black at UMKC has said, the best way to rob a bank is to own one. You come in at the top and you loot it. And Nobel Prize was given for an economist who wrote Looting for Profit, the Wall Street companies that have the hedge funds, like the Republican candidate in 2012, Mitt Romney ran a hedge fund, and he would take over a company. The first thing you do is you loot the pension funds. You tell the workers you're not going to get a defined payment. We'll give a defined contribution where you put money in. You downsize it. You move your operations out of the U.S. to China. And in fact, what's been happening, I'm sure you have the news down in Colombia like you have it in the United States, the tariffs on China. And all the papers are filled with the fact that all these Chinese imports are threatening America. Well, what is a Chinese import? It's an import from Walmart. It's an import from Apple. The Chinese imports are all from American firms operating in China who decide that they can leave the United States, close down the factories here, leave a rust belt, and employ foreign labor. So it's really the American companies' relocation in China and Asia that's causing the problem. But instead of Mr. Trump saying, well, you know, we're really at war with Walmart and other American companies, Boeing, that have shifted all their production to China, he's pretending that somehow these are all Chinese people that are doing it, instead of the Chinese providing a industrial capitalist economy that is not as predatory as the American capitalist economy. Now, there was a corruption there, especially 10 years ago when I was in China. Many of my students were all talking about how they want to go into government and prevent corruption, and I think they largely have. But in America, the most corrupt people have become the major campaign contributors, so they've essentially bought control of the government. So if you're a government that says, we're going to represent are campaign contributors, and most of the money is to be made by financial fraud, the junk mortgage fraud, the pharmaceutical fraud, and unearned income, the rentiers. Well, then you're going to have a government run by the crooks and for the crooks. And certainly the fact that almost all the big banks were complicit in the junk mortgage fraud, the very term junk mortgage means that they knew that there were mortgages that couldn't be paid. And they knew that even though they were writing bad mortgages and falsifying documents, the government couldn't let them fail because they said, if we fail, we're going to screw the depositors. And the government could have said, no, you're not going to screw the depositors. The bondholders and the stockholders are going to lose, but we're going to protect the depositors. That was the whole fight between Sheila Bair and the Obama administration, and that's why Sheila Bair ended up writing her book about it, to expose the fact that Obama was head of a bunch of a gang. He was the head of a financial gang that put him in to serve themselves, and that's what the Democratic Party is unwilling to recognize, and that's basically why they lost the election to Trump.
Yeah, I heard someone recently say that the good of Trump was that he gave us some breathing room. I mean, it was going to be more of the same, and so now we have all kinds of turmoil, and there's all kinds of issues about personality issues, but that's not really the issue. The thing is, there's a lot more, there are more possibilities now. Like Trump is talking about that we should do more quantitative easing. That's what I was just writing about, that if we did quantitative easing the way the Chinese do, it's a good thing. Even if, I mean, it has nothing to do with what the employment level is, the fact that we're at full employment and therefore we should be doing quantitative tightening. I mean, to me, that's just a faulty model, that we need to do qualitative easing where we're actually putting money into the local economy, which is what the Chinese do. And you can put a lot more money out there and not create inflation because you are creating products. So you're creating supply along with demand, and they balance each other out and the prices stay the same.
Well, that's the whole point. Who is the government going to give money to? The government's created over $4.5 trillion worth of money since the 2008 crash, but it's given it to Wall Street. It's given it to the stockholders and the bondholders and the hedge funds that have bought out the 10 million homes that have been foreclosed on and turned them into rental properties, raising the rental payments that Americans have to pay. All this money could have been used to write down debts. It could have been used to provide free education, like in China. Could have been used to provide free medical care, like in China. And it could have been used to basically raise people's living standards and produce more and lighten the tax burden on wage earners, like in China, instead. But the fact is that somebody's gained through all these policies that have made the rest of the economy poor. And the people who've gained are the 1%, maybe the 10%. And they're the people who are controlling both the Republican and the Democratic parties now, and are absolutely dead set on returning money to the financial elites by having some new Obama. Either it'll be someone like Biden, who is a senator for the credit card state, corporate state of Delaware, or they'll have another pig in a pokey that nobody's heard of, and they can just sort of pretend hope and change. But the one thing they want to make sure is that no left-winger, no reformer can come in. Bernie cannot come in. Elizabeth Warren cannot come in. The financial monopolies have bought control of the press and turned the mainstream press into their own lobbyists. And so there's no longer a public press that's independent. There's no longer anything except the internet to go to for people to find a story that isn't the pro-Wall Street story saying, pay higher taxes to give to the 1% and that'll make you free. I don't know how you can solve this problem until people get so poor and the crime rate goes up so high and the suicide rates go up so high that emigration begins and finally the country will do something to prevent its decline. Rome didn't, and the result was depopulation, emigration, and economic collapse. And America now is on such a sharp polarization, so much austerity, so much debt deflation as more and more has to be paid to the government that the plans of both the Republicans and Democrats in 2020 are now to say we've cut taxes on the 1% so much that we don't have any money to pay Social Security or medical care. You're on your own, folks. And we're going to do to you, public Social Security recipients, just what Wall Street has done to the pensioners. We're going to just wipe out the pensions we promised. That's what we call a free market.
Well, this has been a great discussion.
Good, Ellen. It's nice, always nice to be here.
I've been speaking with Michael Hudson, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of 25 books, including his latest, And Forgive Them Their Debts. His books are available on Amazon, and his website is michael-hudson.com.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.